Welcome back to the Educated Patient Podcast. I'm your host, Mike DeMarco, and today we're joined by Dr. Snelling. Our conversation today is centered around stroke. And Dr. Snelling, I appreciate you joining us. I'd love for you to give some context to the audience of where you're calling in from, where you practice, why you practice, and anything else that would be relevant for them to know about you.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Brian Snelling. I'm a physician. I am a board certified neurosurgeon. I've been in practice for about 8 years in Boca Raton, Florida at the Boca Raton Regional Hospital, Marcus Neuroscience Institute, which is a part of Baptist Health South Florida. My background is, like I said, is neurosurgery. You know, I subspecialized in a field called cerebrovascular neurosurgery, which is, the surgical treatment of blood vessel disorders of the brain and spine. And in doing that, I did a 2-year fellowship in what's called endovascular neurosurgery, which is the catheter-based treatment of the blood vessel disorders of the brain and spine, which is where most of the field has gone. So after I got out of training, where I trained at the University of Miami, just went slightly up the road to Boca Raton and became the director of our stroke program there, which I've been for the past 8 years, as well as the director of cerebrovascular neurosurgery. So happy to be here. Happy to talk to you.
Great. Well, I appreciate you joining us. And just right out the gate, I know even for myself, I imagine most people are more familiar with things such as a heart attack, right? And it's not often for me as a common person to necessarily know stroke as well as as much as heart attack, because I don't know, I just feel like there's more instance, right, in everyday life. You at least know one person or two people that have experienced a heart attack, and then stroke, I don't know, at least in my circle, seems to be less frequent. So I'd love to just visit, understanding what that is in the most basic sense.
Yeah, stroke is the fifth leading cause of death in the U.S., but it is the leading cause of serious disability. So a lot of times when people have a stroke, they don't necessarily die from it. So it's the leading cause of serious disability in the United States. Around 1 in 4 people over the age of 25 will have a stroke. And the thing I think that makes it a lot different from something like a heart attack, as you mentioned, is that with a heart attack, a lot of people get not only some sort of symptoms like a crushing chest pain, but they also get like an impending sense of doom. Like people know that something's wrong. And stroke just doesn't work that way. It's pretty silent in that regard. People have some sort of symptom where they have, which we can touch on in a little bit, where they have difficulty talking or maybe a facial droop, or maybe their hand isn't working as well or is numb. And those things can be subtle. And in a sense, a lot of people tend to dismiss those things, hoping they'll go away, I'll sleep it off and whatnot. So conveying to the public that, those symptoms, if people notice things like that, that they are to be taken very seriously, that they need to call 911, that they need to get to a hospital that can treat stroke patients as soon as possible, because we have different therapies we can offer to help reverse those symptoms. That's the goal of this conversation.
So stroke is neurological, right? I don't want to keep referencing heart attack as if it's like this compare contrast, but just sure, for simplicity of understanding, right? Heart attack is obviously in the heart. Stroke is neurological. So is it only brain? Is it like your entire nervous system? Like what exactly is going on?
No, people can have strokes of the spinal cord. That's extraordinarily rare. Whether that's a clot that blocks off one of the arteries of the spinal cord or some sort of bleeding and things like that. So the vast majority of stroke encompasses things that happen to the brain itself.
Got it. And what's exactly going on in the brain when someone's experiencing?
Sure. Yeah, there's two big buckets for, stroke's an umbrella term, and it really comprises a whole subset of different diseases that can affect the blood vessels, the arteries and veins of the brain. And so those really fall into two very big boxes under the big umbrella of stroke. The first box is what we call ischemic stroke. And that ischemic just really means a lack of blood flow. So how this usually would work is a clot comes from somewhere else in the body. It gets sent up to the brain. The brain requires a lot of oxygen, a lot of blood from the heart. So it gets a disproportionate amount of blood flow. And a clot comes from somewhere else. It gets lodged in the sort of arterial tree of the brain. And now no blood can get further downstream. And that part of the brain is not receiving adequate oxygenation. And it can die if that doesn't get restored. So that's really what an ischemic stroke is. And that makes up about 85% of all strokes. The remaining 15% is what we call hemorrhagic stroke. Hemorrhagic, hemorrhage just meaning bleeding. So there are types of strokes that are due to bleeding in the brain. And those really come in two main categories. One is just a bleed in the brain that sometimes due to things like high blood pressure, and the other major sort of box within that is brain aneurysm rupture. So that sort of helps you paint a picture of like how this all looks. So under the umbrella of stroke, there's really two different causes, and the vast majority of those are what we call ischemic stroke.
And so are aneurysms their own kind of subcategory as well, or
Yeah, aneurysms are a category of what we call hemorrhagic stroke, so bleeding in and around the brain. So aneurysms are one of the things that can happen. If an aneurysm were to rupture, then that can cause bleeding in and around the brain. There's other things that can cause that, like I mentioned, high blood pressure, it's never been controlled, things like that. There's also some things that are more rare, but yeah, certainly an aneurysm is one that people hear a lot about, and one that people, worry about if they have one.
Let's walk through the timeline here from symptom or maybe you're feeling or you're seeing symptom in somebody else in all the way through the actual like event of a stroke happening, starting with the symptoms from the first person from what point of view. You mentioned a few already, but let's just revisit or hammer down like what are some of the things that I should be aware of for myself to recognize if I'm experiencing a stroke.
Yeah, so what we tell people that they need to recognize in themselves or in a loved one or a friend or even, somebody out in public is best understood by the acronym BFAST. So B stands for balance. So any loss of balance or imbalance. E stands for eyes, and that can mean blurry vision or double vision or loss of vision. F stands for face. That's a facial droop or facial numbness. A stands for arm, and that's either arm numbness or weakness. S stands for speech. That's difficulty speaking, or that's difficulty understanding what speech is being like said to you. And finally, T stands for time to call 911. So not time to sleep it off, not time to think about whether you want to go to the hospital, not time to drive yourself or have a loved one drive you. It's time to call 911.
I imagine, I mean, that last bit there speaks to time sensitivity. Like, what is, like, how time sensitive is the event of a stroke?
Yeah, so the world of stroke has changed a lot in the past 30 years. Prior to, 30 years ago, if someone were to have a stroke, we really had no therapies for them, for the vast majority of them. But in the past 30 years or so, things have remarkably changed. That started off with being able to give clot busting medication. So if somebody comes in and they're having stroke symptoms, and they meet a certain criteria and they are fall within a certain, number of hours from the last time we knew them to be normal, then they're usually a candidate for clot busting medication. So that's the first thing is that your ability to get some sort of treatment, some sort of IV drug that could break the clot up if a clot is lodged in one of the arteries of the brain depends on how quickly the symptoms get recognized and how quickly you get to the hospital. And the reason for that, and I'll touch back on some of the other therapies, is that really, one of the main things to take away is time is brain. So, for however long an artery is blocked and blood flow can't go downstream, or the neurons are damaged, or they're not getting enough oxygen. They'll go on to suffer irreversible damage, and those cells will die. So, time is of the essence. You hear the phrase of how many millions of neurons die, per second or per minute. I think it's like 1.9 million neurons die every minute during a stroke. That's real, and so that's why all of the therapies that we do and all the effectiveness that we can offer is all time based. So whether that's giving a clot busting medication, whether that's doing something like what I do, which is in patients who have very large clots, we actually go up, we put a catheter up into the arteries of the brain, and we actually grab the clot and we actually remove it and pull it out of the body. And all that's time based. So that's why we recommend you calling 911 so that when EMS evaluates you in the field, they can recognize that you're having a stroke and they actually can pre-alert us as the specialists who treat patients for a living and say, hey, we've got a patient in the field. We think they're having this type of stroke. We're going to bring them to your hospital. And so in parallel, while they're driving you to the hospital, we're actually being activated and we're going to meet the patient at the hospital. And that, shaves at least a half an hour off their time to treatment. So time is brain, every second counts. And that's one of the main things to impart to
A step before the step of the
you.
symptom is our risk factors or lifestyle considerations. Like, what
Sure.
are some factors in that category for listeners to be aware of that they could either be more conscious of, more mindful of, or put into action so that they're reducing their risk for stroke?
Yeah, I think it's best to keep it simple. The same things that are healthy for the arteries that deliver blood to your heart are healthy for the arteries that deliver blood to your brain. So that is, making sure your cholesterol is adequately controlled. If you have high blood pressure, making sure that's adequately controlled, not smoking, no excessive alcohol use, no illicit drug use, making sure that your weight is well controlled, not being overweight, making sure that you're getting adequate exercise, adequate cardiovascular exercise. All those things, basically, those are like the main things. And again, that's pretty easy, right? Because you hear that from your primary care doctor, you hear that from a cardiologist. So the thing, same things that are going to help you prevent having a heart attack are the same things that are healthy for the arteries of the brain that would go on to prevent you from having things that can lead to a stroke.
I'm not sure if this is going to bring us down an unnecessary rabbit hole right now, but
Let's do it.
that came to mind just around genetics or hereditary. Like, is there a component of that that makes me at greater risk? Like, if there's something in my family line with regards to stroke that I should be aware of?
Sure, there's plenty of or I shouldn't say there's several, genetic disorders that can put someone at a higher risk of having a stroke, specifically for things like brain aneurysms. Certainly having a family history of brain aneurysms or having something called polycystic kidney disease or other connective tissue disorders like Ehlers-Danlos, which is pretty rare, can put someone at higher risk of having a brain aneurysm. There are other genetic disorders that can put someone at higher risk of having a clot that can get sent to the brain. So there's several of those. Most of them are fairly rare, if that makes sense.
I'm just like coming to mind, like let's say, for example, I have a family member who's on medication that helps reduce clots because of heart things that they have going on. Is that particular scenario, if let's say for this family member, for example, if they're not compliant and they're not taking their meds, right? And they're, how does that come into?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just gonna guess at what you're describing here. The heart is a pump, and its whole job is to pump, oxygenated blood to, at least the left side of the heart to pump it to the body, and then receives blood back to the veins and whatnot. It gets oxygenated again. So the heart's just a big pump. And people who, for other reasons, are unhealthy, all the things I mentioned, plus another risk factor that I didn't for something for an irregular heartbeat is something called sleep apnea. You can eventually develop an abnormal heart rhythm called atrial fibrillation, and that's just an irregular heart rhythm. And the reason that's important is when the heart doesn't beat regularly, a clot can form in the chambers of the heart. And because it's a big pump, it just shoots that clot out elsewhere in the body. And because the brain demands so much blood and oxygen, a lot of times that clot ends up in the brain. So when people have these irregular heart rhythms, they are often put on blood thinning medications, and the blood thinning medications is to prevent the clot from forming, to prevent them from having a stroke. So that's the whole reason behind that. So a lot of the things I mentioned, making sure your weight's controlled, getting checked for sleep apnea, making sure you don't have high blood pressure, not smoking, keeping your weight under control, all of those things, they go a long way in preventing people from developing, any of those, something like sleep apnea or some other disorders of the heart that can lead to an irregular rhythm.
You nailed my family member with AFib. That word wasn't coming to mind for me in the moment, but that's exactly the scenario, right? So even more the reason when, let's say, for example, they pass in and out of AFib events for whatever reason, right? Even more, or even more the reason for them to, as quickly as possible, get that in check, whether that's like getting with their doc or back on their meds or something like that, with regards to the stroke risk.
And that's not something that I do as a neurosurgeon. Most of those most of that disease, which is really centered around stroke prevention, that's the main risk with atrial fibrillation, or one of the main risks is dealt with by a cardiologist or an electrophysiologist. So those are heart doctors.
What are some common misconceptions with regards to either risk factors or dealing with a stroke that you've come across?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the common risk factors that I think about a lot is that like stroke is a disease of the old. And so it's not stroke ha you know stroke hap is happening in younger and younger people every year. But certainly if you're young and you have those risk factors we talked about, if you're 55 years old and you have high blood pressure and you smoke and your cholesterol is not controlled, your 10-year risk of having a stroke may be one in four, right? So, it's not something that happens to people that who are very advanced in age. And different types of stroke happen in younger people. So certainly things like brain aneurysm rupture is more likely to happen in younger patients. So it's not something that people have to think about at the end of their life. I think keeping their arteries and keeping their blood vessels healthy is something that people should be doing from a young age, not waiting till they're older to start worrying about whether, they're on the right medications or whether they're taking care of themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. I heard a similar sentiment or response from another doc on a different podcast where we were talking about hypertension and very similar kind of response back with regards to, people or younger, I'm in my 30s, right? And in my head, I'm like, I don't need to be aware of X, Y, and Z. I'm still young. And that's, as the years are going on, it's becoming less true that that should be something in your head as a younger person. Like you need to be aware of these risk factors earlier.
Yeah, I mean, the way I would think about it is, most of these risk factors are it's area under the curve, right? So it's how long are you going about with this risk with an elevated cholesterol? How long are you living with an elevated blood pressure, right? So the earlier you can intervene on those things, like someone in their 30s, someone that has sleep apnea, someone that smokes, right? The earlier you can intervene, the lower that area under the curve of you have ha of you having that problem. And the less your chance is going to be of having a problem, later on in life.
So we've started with before the symptoms. We got to the symptoms. We actually started the whole conversation with talking about the actual event of a stroke and an aneurysm and the two different types of strokes. So I want to jump to recovery now. And you mentioned that it's the leading cause, and correct me if I use the wrong words, but I think you mentioned it's the leading cause of disability,
Severe disability.
severe disability. So what does the aftermath look like for the vast majority of patients that you see?
It depends. I think certainly strokes can be fatal, and some people can be left with, a whole spectrum of disability in between, from being severely disabled to having some sort of moderate impairment, to having some sort of mild symptoms. So for a lot of people, they end up needing to go to like an acute rehab hospital. And so, once they're diagnosed with a stroke and they have received treatment and they still have some sort of residual disability afterwards, oftentimes they're not able to go home. And so from the hospital where they're treated, they'll end up going to a rehabilitation hospital. And the purpose behind that is to get stronger, to sort of regain some of the function that they've lost and sort of get them on a fast road to recovery. Much faster than could happen if they were at home, or maybe they went to an outpatient physical therapy center. So it's an aggressive sort of rehabilitation. And I would say like that's one of the main things that's important if someone has a stroke is getting them on a fast, aggressive road to recovery, because we know, that the brain is remarkably plastic and it has an ability to recover, even as we age. But its ability to improve after a stroke is often time limited, meaning we often say the first 6 months after an ischemic stroke, that's usually when you need to be the most aggressive about rehabilitation. And usually after that, patients may plateau or their ability to improve after that may not be as great. It's different for different patients and different types of stroke. Hemorrhagic patients typically plateau a little bit later, maybe a year or so. But certainly early aggressive rehabilitation is the biggest factor. The other one is, for patients, even after rehabilitation, you have to be able to have some sort of support. So I'd say that's one of the biggest things that patients who do well after a stroke have a big social support network, whether that's family, friends, neighbors, things like that. They certainly will benefit more than people who lack that. It's just, it's a little bit of like op being optimistic, but it also is a little bit, you have to balance it with being realistic. The brain has an ability to recover. But for a lot of patients, they are sometimes left with a permanent disability that they can't recover all the way from, right? So certain things they used to be able to do, they can't do anymore. So sort of like living in that new reality is something that people have to deal with. And like I said, having a good social support network often helps with that.
So key takeaway for me today, stroke at the outset, be fast, and stroke in the aftermath, be fast in the recovery pot in the recovery process.
Be fast and be aggressive. Yeah, I mean, I
Yeah.
think like it's as you imagine. It's as aggressive as people can be, pushing it and whatnot. And there's dedicated stroke rehabilitation hospitals. But certainly younger patients are able to recover better because, as you can imagine, their ability to condition to be their conditioning and things like that would allow them to push themselves harder to recover than perhaps someone who's an octogenarian who just doesn't have the ability to do 2 or 3 a day rehabilitation sessions.
And there's also the mindset side of that too, right? If you have a greater runway of head ahead of you, I imagine there's more sense of like either hope or like, I have many more years to live. It's just like a different operating perspective for most.
For most, I mean, I'd say people always surprise you with their ability. Even, I've had patients who've had strokes and undergone procedures in their 90s, and they've made remarkable recoveries. So, I think there's a lot of people who have a lot of individual like willpower, and you can't generalize about say, well, a certain group of people just it doesn't do as well. But my point is that their physical capacity for younger people is often greater.
Sure.
Even if an older person wants to, sometimes they just don't have the ability to.
It's amazing. We're talking about neurological with the brain and how much the brain plays in the recovery process, not just, going through with drugs or the re like you actually have there's a mindset component to it, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
100%.
Last few questions here. One is, what excites you most about developments or technology or conversation or awareness or anything like that in the stroke space right now?
I mean, I think the past 10 years or so, at least what I do for a living, which is, try to repair aneurysms, things like that, remove large clots from the arteries of the brain, do things to either treat stroke or prevent people from having stroke. There's been a lot of focus in what we would call like the cerebrovascular or the neurovascular space. So it's gotten a lot of attention from, medical device manufacturers and researchers and things like that. So the field is it's advanced, very significantly, and it's only going to continue to do so, in the next years, the decades to come. So it's an exciting field to be in, anything from like new technologies to treat brain aneurysms or to remove clots, using artificial intelligence to actually identify patients who are having a stroke as soon as they get to the hospital and have imaging done. We at our hospital, we were the first in Florida to use a very specific artificial intelligence technology to actually diagnose a patient with a stroke before the radiologist could even read the imaging.
Wow.
So things like that are keep me interested and make me happy that I chose this very specific subspecialty.
I love that. And finally, if we could leave the listeners with one thing, one message around stroke, protecting themselves or families or anything of that nature, what would that message be?
If you recognize in yourself or a friend or a loved one that you're having symptoms that you think could be caused, that could be a stroke, pick up the phone, call 911. That's it.
Simple.
Simple.
Dr. Snelling, you seem like a simple man. I appreciate your time today. And for those of you listening that want to go deeper on this topic or find information similar to this, please visit theeducatedpatient.com. Dr. Snelling, thank you once again for your time. Stay tuned for
Thanks.
more episodes on this topic and many others as the year goes on. And have a great day, everybody.